financial piece, appropriations.
Madam Chair and members, I included in your packet is just a one-page handout. The charter school lease aid provision is rather short, and I'll just briefly go over that, and then I'll pass it along to Mr. Nauman to go over the fiscal portion of that. First of all, the mechanism available to charter schools for their lease aid and operating aid is the operating capital revenue, which is also available for school districts. School districts, it is an aid and levy program, but because charter schools don't have a tax base, it is an aid program only for them. Schools then can use the operating capital. There's a number of uses for the operating capital, but it includes acquiring land, acquiring or constructing buildings for school purposes, and various building improvements, and then the basic operating expenses. And that total was $7.386 million in fiscal year 09 for charter schools. If a charter school deems that that amount of money is insufficient to lease or operate their building, there is then the charter school lease aid. The commissioner has a review process that the charter school can goes through to get their lease aid. And I believe the department is going to speak to that further. But the statute does set out a couple of criteria for which the commissioner must review, and that is the reasonableness of the prices based on current market values, the extent to which lease conforms to applicable state laws and rules, and the appropriateness of the proposed lease in the context of the space needs and financial circumstances of the charter school. The charter school lease aid also lists, the provision also lists a couple of things that a charter school cannot use their lease aid on, and that includes custodial, maintenance service, utility, or other operating costs. These are some things that would be covered by their operating capital revenue.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. McQuay. And Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair, members, I believe in your packet you should have a legal size spreadsheet that looks, it's on printed on two sides. That's right, Senator Hamm. And I'm going to work off of that. This began as a legislative request from the chair for lease aid appropriations over time. Thank you. And that's what's in the center of the document that says building lease aid appropriations, dollars and thousands of dollars. So the program, the building lease aid program, was originally passed as part of a 1997 K-12 bill and then has grown over time. So you can see as you track down, perhaps it would be helpful for me to actually do the columns first before I start talking through it. We have the fiscal year, the number of charter schools, and then a plotted percentage growth. The percentage growth percentages look super big in the first couple of years, but that's just because the numbers are really relatively small. Then we have statewide enrollment, and then charter school enrollment as a percentage of the charter school enrollment, and then charters as a percentage of the total statewide enrollment. Then we have the building lease aid appropriations, and then an annual growth percentage. And again, you're going to see really big percentages at the beginning. And then to sort of talk through some of the mitigating issues that might explain some of the differences that might look kind of funky, we have some notes on the far right-hand column. Some of the other language here is a discussion of the lease limits, lease aid limits, because those have changed over time on a few occasions that I'll highlight in just a moment. And then for your information, the statutory reference, it's changed at least once with a recodification. So if you want to go back and see what the actual language looked like back in 1997, you'd have to go back to an old statutory reference. So that's your guide for that purpose. Initially, when the program was begun in 1998, I believe was our first fiscal year. Correction, I'm sorry, the program goes back. Yeah, that's right. In 1997 was in the first bill. We had a formula that was based on 80% of costs or the pupil units times what was referred to an average, the average debt redemption fund plus the plus capital revenue on a statewide basis. So it was basically keyed to district revenue. In 98, there was no change, but we did recodify the location of the language. In 1999, the K-12 bill had changed the formula to 90% of costs or the pupil units times $1,500, and it's the lesser of these two, and that's sort of how the formula works. It's the lesser of one or the other. So we have a numerical cap or costs. Then in 2000, 2001, 2002, there were relatively no changes, with one addition. In the 2002 pension bill, there was some language tucked in there to reduce the charter school building lease aid on a prorated basis to pay for charter school retirement contributions that were running short in that year. Then in 2003, that was the last year we had a substantial budget shortfall, not as large as the one that we're facing this year. But in that year, we reduced the formula to 90% of costs or the greater of your fiscal 2003 lease aid, or $1,200 times the pupil unit. So the cap was reduced. And that's the formula as it stands today.
So just a question on that, Mr. Nauman. Was that is that now in effect for all schools, or were some schools grandfathered in at a different
I think the way to think about that, Madam Chair, is that if the formula is the lesser of your 03 mm-hmm. revenue versus the 03 amount that you were receiving or the new cap. And in some cases, what that had the effect of doing was, in effect, grandfathering some of the charter schools in that were at a higher than a $1,200 per pupil cap. So some of the older charter schools might be falling under that. I'm sure Dr. Melcher can go into more detail about
Very
that.
Very good. Thank you
But that
very
was
much.
Sort of how we enacted some savings in the lease aid program at that point. I think it is useful to see that the program began at about $1 million, and we're now through the end of the projection period, looking at appropriations that are approaching $54-55 million. And of course, there's a substantial amount of charter school expansion at the same time, so it's not unexplainable. It's not the same charter schools getting the money. We are adding charter schools.
So if I might just note there, it looks, even though there was a reduction in lease aid available to each charter school, the appropriation did grow. It wasn't actually the total amount was not cut. It was just how it was distributed. Would that be correct?
I'm sorry. Maybe you can point to where you're referring.
I'm looking at, because in 2003, when we had our last budget deficit that was of great significance, to address the fact that we were trying to, we were not trying to cut our schools. So as a way to use the dollars differently, there was a cap put on the lease costs or the $1,200 per student. But the actual amount in lease aid did not go down.
Well, I think that maybe the way some of this is, yeah, I mean, the answer is yes, but I would suggest that it's due to the expansion of the number of charter schools.
Right.
That was the primary driver.
Did he say 54
and 55? You know, we've looked at this in the past and on data runs, and we can see that there is charter schools are savvy, and they make choices based on the formulas that are available, and often charters are signing leases at or about that $1,200 per pupil. And I think that maybe Dr. Melcher will bring a data run. I think that's his intent. So you can take a look at some of that.
So perhaps that the issue then is that do you cap the number of charter schools, or do you use the dollars that you have to support the existing schools that you have? I mean, there was a trade-off, it sounds like, to some extent.
Well, I would think that the capping of the charter schools is certainly something that the Senate has examined in the past. That's a policy choice for members to think about. The E-12 division in the Senate has also taken a look at an overall cap of the total appropriation. It's been probably 4 years since that approach has been looked at. But I think that there was, at the time, some feeling among senators that maybe the growth was higher than they were comfortable with. And so when you make an overall cap on the overall appropriation, that tends to force some proration. And I think there was concerns about that kind of effect on various charter schools.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Nauman. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
On, I guess this would be for Ms. McQuay. When you're telling us the operating capital revenue covers acquiring land, acquiring construction or school purpose, various building improvements, and basic operating expenses. So a charter school that starts up in a certain year and finishes their construction or whatever they do, they still are eligible for lease aid for basic operating expenses. Is that true?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, yes. They still, just because they're getting charter school lease aid doesn't mean they don't get operating capital revenue. They do receive both, and in statute it lists 16, 17.
But it's different. Sorry. Lease aid and operating revenue are two different things.
Correct.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Well, thank you very much. So at this time, if Ms. Chenode would come up from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and I do want to know that this is a report from 2003, so thank you. I'm sure you've been brushing up on it. And I think members do have a copy of this report, but I believe we also have a PowerPoint in our packets.
Oh, as we do have
I
that.
Believe we do have the PowerPoint.
Our equipment didn't quite make it here, so.
Did it? Do we have the PowerPoint? We do not have the PowerPoint.
Sure,
excuse
we do.
Me. Wait, we do have the PowerPoint.
Is that it?
We have the printed off PowerPoint. So that's great. We really appreciate that. And then members, you also have the 2000. You have two. You have the 2008 and 2003 report, and to reference as well. So thank you, Ms. Chenode, for coming today.
Happy to be here, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Deborah Parker Chenode. You were close.
Thank you. I knew I was not saying it.
That's
right,
all right.
Thank you.
And I'm with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I'm here just to briefly talk to you about our 2003, it's the one with the picture, charter school report on financial accountability. We had a small portion of evaluative work with this project that dealt with lease aid, and I'm just going to talk to you about the portion of the work from 2003 that dealt with that. It has been a long time, and I'm very happy that Dr. Melcher is here from the Department of Education to talk to you about the current nitty-gritty having to do with lease aid and the approval process, but I can speak to what we said back in 2003. First, I would like to give you just a quick overview of the state laws that were that set the context for the work that we did back then. First, traditional sources of financing are not available to charter schools for the purposes of obtaining a building. The board of directors of a charter school may not levy taxes or issue bonds, and money received from the state may not be used to purchase land or buildings. Those are prohibitions that are clearly set in law. And because of that, in the 1997 legislature established charter school aid, which again is that separate pocket of aid that specifically is state money that's available for a charter school to lease a building. The Department of Education approves those leases, and they're going to be talking about that in some detail, so I don't want to go into that too much right now. But they look at things like the reasonableness of the price, the reasonableness of the facility that's being leased compared to the size and the resources of the charter school. And they'll talk about that in more detail. As to what we did in 2003, our first finding, if you switch over, it's a slide that says OLA's 2003 findings. It's the fifth or sixth one in your packet. The first thing we said was that lease aid is a very important component of charter school financing. And in fact, the school directors told us that lease aid was essential to their financial viability. We took a look at how the charter school's lease rates compared to comparable state buildings, both metro and outstate, again, to try to get some sense of reasonableness. And we did find that they compared in a reasonable way. I mean, it was an imperfect comparison. There are a lot of differences why a state lease building might differ from a charter school's building, but we didn't see anything there that raised alarms with us. We also compared the amount of space that the charter schools were leasing to Department of Education guidance for elementary, middle school, and high schools, again, for a ballpark test on whether the amount of space was reasonable. And again, we didn't find any big problems there, and said that the amount of space the charter schools was leasing was a reasonable amount of space given their needs. The one finding from the report, if you switch to the next slide, that I do want to focus on today, we identified one important issue, and that is that there were 11 schools, and there are more now, I think 27 at current count, where the charter schools established an affiliated nonprofit, and that nonprofit bonded or got loans to buy a building, and then state money, lease money, went to to make the payments on those bonds and loans. And, you know, we think that really introduced a gray area in the law, since the specific language of the law prohibits state funds from use to buy buildings. This kind of workaround, we thought, was something that the legislature really needed to address directly for clear and transparent policy on charter school ownership. One thing we looked at, just again as a kind of a gut check, we looked at the cost impact of using these affiliated nonprofits to buy a building. And the per pupil costs were somewhat higher for the 11 schools that had used this mechanism, but not dramatically so. And, you know, some argued to us that over the long term, when you consider that the bonds were going to be paid off eventually, that the long term cost of this mechanism really would even out. But
the
again,
on that, Ms. Janot, if I might, the long term cost may be lower after the bonds are paid off, but there's nothing right now that would not allow the nonprofit to continue to seek lease aid. So it may be a savings if we were to address that. Potentially.
And Madam Chair, yes. I think our point of view from the Legislative Auditor's Office is be clear and transparent mm-hmm. about what the policy is going to be and what will happen with the disposition of assets at the point the bonds are paid off, who owns that building, you know, what authority does the state have. And we came out and said that the practice circumvents the prohibition against using state funds to buy buildings. And our recommendation in the report said that the legislature should review and clarify this policy on building ownership. And as the senator said, to date, the legislature has not acted on that recommendation from 2003. I'll just close with a couple of the policy considerations. I was thinking about what is it that we want clarified in law. And first, you know, the legislature, we think, should explicitly authorize or prohibit the use of these affiliated nonprofits to buy buildings. Or alternatively, the legislature could say, you know, we've got a lot of experience with charter schools now. Perhaps it's time for us to authorize charters to buy buildings directly under certain circumstances, you know, with maybe certain meeting certain criteria for financial health or having been in existence for 8 or 10 years or something like that. We also think that the legislature's policy should clarify what happens to that asset if the charter school closes, given that it's been state money involved in the transaction. And another issue actually raised more in our 2008 charter school report, and I know Judy Randall was here to speak with you a few meetings ago, I think, about that 2008 report, but one of the issues that evaluation raised was conflict of interest between boards. And again, I would reiterate, you know, refer to the 2008 OLA report on conflict of interest and make sure that state policy lines up with where you want it to be in terms of how those boards between the charter school and the affiliated nonprofit overlap or don't overlap. And with that, so just to sum up, clarity and transparency in the law, that's really what our report in 2003 was about.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Chanel, appreciate your coming back and reviewing this. And I, just for clarification, I apologize, I have not gone back and read the report in its entirety from 2003, but maybe you could help my memory. In your findings, did you talk at all about the reasonableness of the prohibition on owning buildings? In other words, we have lots of public school buildings owned by use of state dollars across the state. And I know we have this in the charter law that says, no, I wasn't here when the charter law was passed. I'm not sure if I understand completely what the prohibition is intended to do. And is I notice in your recommendation you're saying we should clarify that, but is that a clarification with a view that the auditor may have to inform us on that directionally, or is that something you're just saying, well, go figure it out?
Senator Saltzman, Senator Hahn, we did not come down with a recommendation in one direction or another. I think at the time that prohibition was enacted, you know, charter schools were still relatively new. There was concern about what will happen with the state assets if charter schools were folding. We didn't have a lot of information about the longevity of charter schools. So I think that's part of what was behind the prohibition initially. I think we didn't make a recommendation in particular, but we also didn't have a lot of heartburn about the thought of charter schools owning buildings. Our issues had more to do with let's make it clear about which charter schools, when, let's make it clear what will happen if a charter school folds. I think that's a key question that needs to be dealt with.
Thank you.
So at that point, Senator Hahn, I think that this group, or how I have approached this whole working group, is that, you know, we really haven't changed a lot of charter school laws in the past 15 years. We've allowed them to work, and there are some instances where there are questions. So I think that we look at this information, and as you asked, what, you know, is there some reasonableness? Well, that's perhaps our discussion. Should we go back and look at that? And then if we determine that there should be a way for charter schools to own building, where is the transparency? And we are using state dollars essentially through lease-aid to purchase them. So what does that mean? And I don't have the answer, but I think it's really caused a lot of us to sort of just think about it. And I hope that that's why we can listen today. And I think there's also a sense that we're not really sure how some of this money is being used or how the organizations are being set up. So in understanding them, I think we might see opportunities to address these concerns and these issues. And Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for coming. Just a couple of questions, and the department has some more information. But with what you know about this, were those 11 buildings that were during your time, were they all new, or some of those existing spaces? Do you recall?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, four were new buildings. The rest were purchase of existing buildings. Eight of the organizations had their affiliated nonprofits go to the City Housing and Refinance Agency, and they issued tax-exempt bonds. The other schools used either a combination of bonds and bank loans. One used only a bank loan.
And thank you. And do you know that the four that were new, did those, I know that if you want to build a new school, like my district wants to build a school, they have to go through a whole list of, you know, there's a whole book of things they have to do that are specific to school buildings. Do you know, did the department review those plans of those four with the same kind of scrutiny that they do on a regular building, regular new school building? Do you know that?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, I don't know if they were involved in the actual planning when the building was being built, but I think still for part of the lease aid, the department would have had to approve the appropriateness of that building against all the regular criteria for charter school buildings, and a lot of that includes health and safety sorts of issues that are common to other public school buildings. I think the department is probably the best one, to answer that question.
Yeah. The question, Representative Abler.
I have 10. I'm just having only three. Did you ever hear of a time with these 11 or the rest of the 26 or 27 where they, with a building that they took over and had all fixed up, either new or otherwise, the department said, no, that building doesn't work, we're not going to give you the money that you're already on track to take, or did they always give the money out?
Senator Saltzman, Representative Abler, I do not know of any instance where the application to use the lease aid for that building was rejected.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Genote? Well, thank you very much for coming, and we really certainly appreciate you coming forward and sharing with us the work that you did on this issue. So this time, I believe that Dr. Melcher and Morgan Brown from the Department of Education, or maybe not Morgan, maybe somebody else, is coming to talk with us to just share a perspective on MDE's role in the process for applying for lease aid, the approval process, and anything else you'd like to share with us today. And thank you so much for being here.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. I also have Lisa DeRamey with me here. We have a handout in your packet.
Yes, we do.
Which is kind of a summary of the trends in terms of funding for leases. Since the report came out, we thought it might be helpful to give you an update in terms of what's happened since that time. We also have some updates on school-by-school information. We think we can answer a few of your questions as they relate to the grandfather and how that affects individual schools. And then we also are going to go through a little bit of information from our application packet and the process we go when charter schools apply for lease aid. So turning to the inside cover, we have a table that provides you some statistical information from 2003 when the OLA report left off up to the most recent information that we have that parallels what Mr. Nauman presented in terms of the growth of charter schools over that time period. We've gone from 78 schools to 143. Nearly all of them do get lease aid. There are a few that do not. There's one, for example, that owns its own facility, and so therefore they don't get any lease aid. Some of the more interesting lines that just to highlight for you, the line 6 is the square foot per ADM, and you can see that been very stable. We have roughly 125 square feet per ADM, which is, I think, probably a little lower than the typical school district would have in terms of its square footage per ADM. Going down to the statistics down on lines 13 through 16, you can see that the average amount of lease aid per student has been essentially constant over the years, a little bit of a decline in lease aid per student. The average amount of cost or aid per square foot leased has also been fairly stable, a slight increase in recent years. The average amount per school has stayed fairly constant. We've had some increase, so now we're up to about $235,000 per school. And on the average, the lease aid is covering about 84% of the cost. It's a maximum of 90%, but some schools are over the limit. So if you turn to the next page, the second table, will provide you with information on the school-by-school information. And the report in the packet itself was by charter school number, but then we realized after the fact that that might be hard for you to find individual schools, so I provided to Mr. McHenry a separate list that also shows these alphabetical, so they're a little bit easier to find. So what this shows, in the first column, the auditor's report looked at schools that had a building corporation and made some comparisons, so we put a little X next to the schools that had a building corporation. We can do some statistics at the end to compare them. We currently have 27 of those as opposed to the 11 that there were back at the time of the OLA report. And then we just show the actual lease amount, the square footage, the lease per square foot, and you can see there's quite a bit of variation among the schools and what they're paying per square foot. You had a question earlier about the grandfather provision, and the fourth column from the right shows the grandfathered amounts for those schools that do have a grandfathered provision. So many of the older schools are, in fact, funded based on the grandfathered amount as opposed to the $1,200 limit that's currently in effect. The very last column is showing the percentage of the actual cost that's funded. And if you see a 90% there, that means that they're able to cover the full 90% of their cost within the cap that we have, either the $1,200 or the grandfathered amount. Or if you're seeing a smaller number, for example, you'll see for the Metro Deaf School, it's only covering 34% of their cost. They have a relatively high cost, being a special education center, relatively higher needs than a typical school. And so their lease aid would not cover quite as large a percentage. That's covering 34%. I think that's one of the lowest in terms of a percentage. I'm not sure what I'm doing there. That's covered. So the very end of this table, if you go to the third page of the table, you'll see some summary information. And there we did make an effort to try to compare charter schools with building corporations versus charter schools that do not have building corporations. And there was a little bit of difference, but not a dramatic difference. Overall, the average cost per square foot was $11.26, and $0.06, and that was about a little over $12 for schools that had building corporations versus about $10.85 for schools that did not. The average square foot per ADM was almost identical between the schools with and without building corporations. and the percentage of cost that was funded was basically identical between the two groups. If you turn to the next page of the handout, page 5, we get into the process that the department uses in administering the program. And at this point, I'd like to introduce Lisa DeRemy, who works on my staff in the program finance area. And I will say that we've had a fair amount of turnover and challenges within our division. We had some very experienced, longstanding people in the finance area who retired this year. We lost both of our two people. And Lisa has really been in the community education area, but has been filling the gap here for us temporarily, working on charter school lease aid along with her regular assignment dealing with the community education program. So Lisa has agreed to kind of step you through the highlights of the application process for lease aid.
Thank you, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What you have on pages 5 through, I believe, 12 is the application and instructions, a packet for fiscal year 2009. First few pages, again, review the statutes, which have already been covered by legislative staff here. And if you will forward to page 8 of the instructions, you'll see the documents that we require of charter schools for the annual lease aid application process. I'll mention that even though these leases may be anywhere from 1 to several years in length, lease aid is an annual process, and we will not load or calculate a lease entitlement, aid entitlement for a charter school until the application has been received and reviewed and approved by the department. For schools that are staying in the same space, you'll see, and as well as for schools with new facilities, we require a cover letter formally requesting lease aid. And then two forms that are filled out by all schools applying, a part 1 on page 10 of your handout and a part 2 on page 11. We also request a copy of the actual lease agreement and any changes to that agreement that have occurred since the last lease aid approval. Where the additional information comes in is if a school is moving to a new facility, and in that event, the requirements or the documents submitted are more lengthy. Just to highlight a few of the requirements, on items 1 through 7, we asked for information about the construction of the facility, including photos. Again, I think the legislative auditor's study in 2003 cited, given staff shortages, the ability to view and actually do on-site visits is somewhat limited, so we are requiring pictures of the interior and exterior of the facilities as part of that application packet, as well as a schematic of the building, identifying the space that's leased, and a description of both the size, dimensions, and then the use of that space for the charter school program. An important document that's required for a charter school is a certificate of occupancy for Group E, or educational use, and that is a document that's required of all new and existing charter schools. Under board information, a charter school may not lease from a for-profit entity if there is a board member who has a related interest in that property. So as part of due diligence, we do ask information about current board members and their affiliation. Charter schools are asked to provide a statement of assurances that no member of the board has an interest in that project. On page 9, you'll see the program information we require of new applicants, and that is, again, a description of the types of educational programs they're going to be conducting in the facility, and again, how that space supports any need for, say, a conference, small group instruction, resource center, computer center, and other needs of the charter school. The health and safety requirements are a big piece of the lease aid approval process. The certificate of occupancy for Group E, again, building code, enforced by the Department of Labor and Industry is a big piece of guaranteeing that the space is safe and appropriate for an educational use. Second, fire safety. Charter schools, like public schools, are required to be inspected by the state fire marshal on a three-year interval basis. But we require that the school, if it's a new facility, have proof of a state fire marshal's inspection and then compliance of any with any violations of the state fire code for public schools. There are two federal laws that also apply to charter schools. One is the Asbestos Hazard Emergency Response Act, a federal requirement that if the facility is to be occupied as a public school, it must first, if it hasn't been, inspected for presence of asbestos. In the case of new buildings, we ask the school provide a letter from a licensed architect or the contractor for that project that demonstrates the building was not constructed with any asbestos-containing materials. Again, another federal requirement, the Title II of the ADA does apply to all programs of the charter school. It's not specifically a facilities code, but we do require evidence that and assurances from the charter school that the facility has accessible bathrooms, hallways, and entrances to meet ADA requirements. And that, in a nutshell, are the criteria that we use to review and approve applications for leasing.
Good. Question first. So, Senator Bonhoff, and then Representative Norton, and Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a few questions. When you receive this information, what is the process? Who has the accountability in the department to review it? And then what is the process by letting a charter school know that they're not in compliance, and who gets copied on that? Since my time in the legislature, I've not seen any of this information. So to just, I'm curious, what is the process of oversight?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, the applications for lease aid do come into our division in the Department of Education, the Program Finance Division, and our staff does do the reviews. There are times when we do consult with the Department of Administration, especially with new leases involving charter schools that are leasing from sectarian organizations or for-profit organizations, and then we will respond to the charter school in terms of their eligibility for lease aid. So it does come out of our division within the Department of Education.
And Madam Chair, Dr. Melcher, is there, though once somebody's been approved, is there a process every so many years to relook at them? How do we know that what they provided for on their original application is then, in fact, followed up? What's that process?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, we do require the application materials to come in each year. It's not just a one-shot and you continue to get funding. Back on page 8 of our handout, we did identify the kinds of documents we require. The top half of the page is for the schools that are staying in the same space. It's kind of a condensed kind of application process. And for those that are new, we do have some additional documentation that we require. But we do require every charter school to apply every year to continue to receive its lease aid. But there are some limitations on what the department can review if they're in the fifth year of a lease and they've been in the same space and it's kind of a continuation of the existing lease. But we do require some minimal level of accountability that they're still where they were and we have some basic information.
Dr. Melcher, Madam Chair, I think this highlights the importance of looking at the recommendation that the auditor's report saying that perhaps if we put more emphasis on the sponsor, because I would think it's a very cumbersome process for the department to have to be looking school by school. That just seems very onerous given all the other responsibilities of the department. And so I'm hopeful that that's one of the things that will come out of this work. And then my last follow-up question is I have two charter schools, one that's in my district, the Beacon Academy, and then the Main Street School is a Hopkins School District school. While it's not in my district, I pay attention to it because it's in my my school district. And it seemed like the numbers I looked at, The lease aid is a percent. You know, they were very low, like 54, 57, and they're not a special ed school. And then the cost lease amount per ADM looked to me like it might be the highest of any of the schools. And I'm wondering if you know anything about that or any comments. The Main Street Performing Arts.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, you said Beacon Preparatory? Because yeah, there's Beacon Academy and there's Beacon Preparatory.
Oh, well, and by the way, Beacon looked fine when I looked at it, but the one I'm concerned about is the Main Street.
Main Street.
Performing Arts.
4110.
They're hard to find because...
Yes, and Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, we did do a second version of the spreadsheet that's sorted alphabetically, so they're a little easier to find on that one than the one that we had in the original.
And
we realized afterward it was hard to...
I should have noted the the number, the line number.
4110.
Yeah, 4110, Main Street School Performing Arts. If you see the lease amount per ADM is $26.87, and I kind of eyeballed it, and I didn't see anything higher than that.
What I would say, just looking at that one, sorry, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Senator Bonoff, is that the lease cost per square foot for them looks pretty reasonable. They're in the ballpark, $13.87 per square foot, a little bit above the average, but not terribly so, the average being about $11. But I think what stands out to me is the 194 square feet per ADM. So they have relatively large amount of space for the number of students that they have, and it may be that they, I don't know for sure, perhaps they leased the space thinking they would have some growth in the number of students, and so they have a relatively high amount of square foot per student, and that then, given the fact that the lease aid is limited to $1,200 per student, it's not that they're paying a lot per square foot, they're paying a little above average, it's more that they have a lot more square footage than the typical school, and it could very well be they thought they'd have 300 students, they ended up with 200, and so they got a building that's a third empty, and they're paying the rate for the whole building.
Madam Chair, Dr. Melcher, I think you've answered my question because they're a performing arts school, and so they probably have the theater, and they have a stage, and so that is probably why it's different, and so that was helpful. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize if I'm asking you to be redundant, but I did step out for a moment. And you have a great list here on the charter schools with new facilities or additional space about what they have to have. I guess my question is, in comparison to the school district that I come from, if they're going to lease, they have the option to lease a building, what rules don't they have to follow that perhaps a school did? You said what they do have to follow. Are there things that they don't have to follow that a school district would as far as the leasing of new facilities requirements?
Madam Chair and Representative Norton,
Dr. Melcher.
I would say with school districts, most of the facilities that they're acquiring are through construction. And so school districts will go through a review and comment process. Very early in the process, they will be working with an architect, they will submit information to
on existing buildings.
To the department. This is for new buildings. For existing buildings, school districts have a fairly similar process. There is a building lease levy authority for school districts. It's much more limited in scope because most school districts are not leased. They are able to levy, I think it's $150 per pupil unit for their leased facilities, and we go through kind of a similar process where they've gone through the same sorts of selection process. They've already identified the space that they plan to lease, and typically because this is a much smaller piece of the overall pie for school districts, we have a fairly limited process in terms of reviewing those leases that have already been signed, primarily making sure that they're not exceeding the limit that we'll allow for the tax levy. And I think that the charter school lease review process is probably a little bit more stringent than what we do with school districts, typically because the school district leases tend to be more for smaller pieces. They're leasing space for athletic fields, or they're doing a building lease where they're adding on to a building. In those cases, we do a review and comment if they are, in fact, if fact, adding space.
And, Madam Chair, if I could just follow up, what I'm trying to get at is, and I do happen to live in one of those districts that has that authority, and we needed space for a new middle school. We looked at leasing an existing building in our community, and I was just trying to get at are the requirements that the school district would have to go through in leasing a building and making sure it's appropriate the same requirements that a charter school might do, or are there exceptions, or are there different rules, as I was just trying to get at that.
Madam Chair and Representative Norton, I think if we're talking an existing facility, not a new facility being built, for a school district, there's a prohibition on receiving a lease levy for building a new facility for general education purposes. Yep. But if it's an existing facility, I think the requirements would be pretty comparable.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And Senator Han, and then Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess a similar question maybe to what Representative Norton was getting at. The level of scrutiny, and again, I just in the testimony there was some discussion about charter schools compared to public schools, and I think we ought to make it clear for the record that charter schools are public schools. And one of the concerns that I want to clarify is that the level of scrutiny and the requirements that are put on a charter school are very, very similar to what is put on a traditional public school for purposes of acquiring a lease. And I think, Mr. Melcher, you just basically testified to that. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Senator Han, we have the same requirements, for example, for health and safety at facilities.
Right.
They have to meet the building codes. They have to pass the fire inspections. All those sorts of things are the same. I think the big difference would be that typically with a school district acquiring facilities, we have a little bit more upfront involvement at the Department of Education, where we go through, by statute, the review and comment process. And because charter schools are leasing facilities rather than buying facilities, we typically don't have that same sort of upfront review and comment. If they're working with someone to lease a space, it's probably something that's already out there. And so we don't have the opportunity to work kind of through the design process.
And thank you. And Madam Chair and Mr. Melcher, the point I guess I'm trying to get at clarification and have you clarify for the committee perhaps is that these two systems as public school entities are treated comparably by the department in the sense that the same kinds of expectations are required of whether it's a traditional public district or a charter school, and the same level of scrutiny and oversight. Is that a fair characterization to make, that there is not a bias within the department one way or the other, that or in law, that would say this particular form of public school would be treated preferentially versus another? I guess what I'm trying to just clarify and get testimony that these two forms of public schooling are treated in law and by the department comparably, without bias.
Madam Chair and Senator Han, I think that that's an accurate general statement as it relates to leasing of existing facilities, and I just think there's some fundamental underlying differences when it comes to review and comment for a bond issue as opposed to leasing an existing facility.
Okay. And Madam Chair, that my last question is kind of speaks to that. Is there anything in the department's view that is an impediment to the idea of having a charter school own a building? Now, I know there's lots of concerns about how that ownership would take place, and I think we all would agree that the appropriate level of transparency and accountability of the public would be in place. But the law says right now charter schools cannot own a building. Is there anything in the department's view that would require a public school to be treated differently in that case versus a traditional public school, other than the fact that we have the law that says you can't do it?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Chaz Anderson, Deputy Commissioner. Senator Han, that's an issue that we've talked about a lot at the legislature over the last 5 or 6 years, about charter school being able to own a building versus leasing a building. The concern that we have about charter schools owning a building is that, at least initially in the first years of operation, a charter school can be very unstable. And if the charter school closes, how do we dispose of that asset? I've personally been through 5 or 6 closures of charter schools. It's hard enough to dissolve a charter school in a nonprofit without having a physical asset to dispose of. And so we would have concerns about initially allowing a charter school to own a building. There's some legal issues also about, does the state own the asset versus the nonprofit? If it's if it's owned by the charter school, and those issues would need to be resolved. So it would have to be very, I think, tightly written and regulated if the charter school was going to get into the business of owning buildings.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. And Representative Abler.
Thank you. This has been fascinating. I just should disclose for the sake of the members who don't know me very well that I've been involved with the charter school, two of them now, since 1994. At one time I founded one and rented to them. And I'm happy. I'm renting one now, and I'm happy to see my lease rate is $6 a foot and that they're not at the cap. So I'm relieved about that. We tried to keep it low enough so that wouldn't happen. So I've been dealing with lease aid matters since it first came out in more ways than one. But my concern is, as I watch these building corporation things unfold, and the department expressed through Chaz Anderson that they're concerned about charter schools owning property when they, in fact, do own property through a group that may be exactly the board of the charter school who's not allowed to own property. And I was looking at your data here, and I'm actually a friend of charter schools, and when I bring these up, people think I'm an opponent of charter schools, but I just want it to work. And my thinking in getting our charter school founded was to find a new way, would it work as well, or it would be different than our local school district. We never criticized the school district. We thought, let's try a different model and see what happens. But I just noticed that the building corporation charter schools tend to be twice. There's 40,000 students. They're twice as big. There's a factor of two. They have, which is kind of interesting. And they're the building's twice as big, and they have twice as many students. And so I know, at least in the case of one charter school that did a building corporation, they figured out what their lease would be, and then they said how many kids they needed to put into that building to make it float. And as a person who wants to, be a proponent of things that are good, I'm concerned that building corporations drive bigger schools based upon math, which is a school subject, I guess, by the way. But I'm concerned that they're the de facto owner of that building through this group of people who are the same or many of the same members of the school board. And I raised this concern 5 years ago, and it's just things get going on. I'm puzzled by it and a bit troubled, a bit potentially. The review and comment component that they don't have to do because they're leasing from this corporation of themselves, running the nonprofit, I think is a piece that somebody thought was a good thing to do for a traditional public school. And now here is this group of an unknown entity with an unknown future about this building. Should this school fold up? Who owns that building? Can the nonprofit sell it and take the money and put it into another worthy purpose? Probably they can. Can they get paid lease aid for 100 years? Probably they can. And so my question is, since the department, I asked the auditor, and my question for you is, the only control in that is the department saying, no, we're not going to pay that much money for this project, but it's all after the fact. And it seems to me your hands are kind of tied. Here comes a project that's, 50,000 square feet, and it's going to be, $5 million to build, or $6 million. They want a lease aid of $400,000, and they're all ready to go, and you have to say no. And I don't know. Have you ever said no to one of those deals? That's my first question. And I mean that in a friendly way. It's hard to say no, but have you ever, as a department, said, no, we're not going to fund that project?
Well, I think that's an important question because as we see the trend that, that this is a trend, and it's not breaking the law, but it is happening. And I think that's the importance of this, of our meeting today, is to understand this is a trend that is going on, and what happens if a school is developed, is there a review and comment? Because the state is not at risk; it's the bondholders. But that's a very difficult question. That would be another issue I'm sure you would not want to deal with, Ms. Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, I did ask a question. I wonder if they ever have denied one or offered advice that maybe you want a little smaller building, or maybe this is a lot of money. Or have you ever had those dialogues with a nonprofit corporation that's building this?
Madam Chair and Representative Abler, I'm not aware of a situation where that's occurred, but we can go back and double check to make sure. I haven't had this area within my division for a lot of years, but we can do some historical checking on it.
Hey, Madam Chair, and I'm not here as an unfriendly person. I just want to. It's something that's the auditor says it's a loophole. The department's concerned about ownership issues, and it's just an interesting little quirk in the law. And the first time I heard about it, I was thought that was a curious way to do business. We set up almost an identical group to do what the first group couldn't do. Do you have an opinion? Let's say, have you thought about the disposition later? In 30 years when the bonds pay off, or 15 years, would the department then decline to pay? It's still too early for that, but if the bonds pay off and there's no more debt on that building, do you feel like you could decline to pay lease aid on that building with the current law?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, to that question specifically, I'm not sure that the law would provide us to prohibit a payment. We haven't been far enough along in this process to even encounter that situation, and that's a topic we've discussed, and I think that it would be more appropriate to pass a law to prohibit the department from paying the lease aid in that situation. But again, it hasn't been – a lot of those bonds are 20- to 30-year bonds, and so we haven't reached maturation of the bonds and faced that situation. The second issue that I want to point to the members to is on page 4, which lists the summary data, and it talks about the charter schools with building corporations being double the size of without building corporations. And I think that's just the natural effect of those that have building corporations have been in business longer, and so therefore they're going to be larger as they've attracted more students to the charter schools over the years. It's going to be very difficult for a startup charter to secure a bank loan, a private bank loan, or go to a private bond market, knowing that they've only been in business for a year or 2 years. So I think part of that is just the natural occurrence of those schools being in more established for many years before they've gone out to, with a building corporation. But if you look at also the per ADM, it's about comparable. It's about 123 per ADM for those charter schools with building corporations and 126 without. So I just want to note that as well. I did have experience of having one charter school we did at the department that closed with a building corporation that was Village School in Northfield. That charter school was sponsored by the Northfield Public Schools. The school district decided to terminate the contract for cause. The department upheld that decision. It actually went to the Court of Appeals. And in that case, the charter school and the sponsor and the state were not responsible for that building, but the building corporation was ultimately liable for the monies it owed on the building. So they had to either continue to make payments or they had to sell the building and satisfy the bondholders, or their third option is default on the bonds.
In reviewing the applications, if there is a building corporation that either owns the building or may lease the building, do you ever ask for what is the actual cost to pay off the bonds versus the lease that is being charged? And not to say this is happening, but could a building corporation, a friends group, charge a greater lease than the actual cost that is incurred to them so that they are accumulating, you know, dollars for another use?
I think.
Go ahead. Madam Chair, of the leases applications that I've reviewed for 09 that involve building corps, in most cases the lease agreement itself, for purposes of rent, will reference a bond schedule. Mm-hmm. That said, it may be the case that, again, the charter school building corp may also include costs for maintenance as well in that lease agreement. But once again, we only count 90% of the approved costs for purposes of lease aid.
Okay. Are there other questions? Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Anderson, when you raised the court case, it made me wonder how many times the departments had to go to court with regard to charter schools over the years. Could you shed some light on, you know, if not exactly how many, kind of what that looks like? Have you done it a lot? What are the types of cases that you are in court for?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, we typically, at least in the last 3 or 4 years, have at least 2 or 3 charter school closures each year. Some are very simple to close down. Others have not been as simple to close down and have required us to go to court. In the last 3 years, we've had 2 charter schools where we've been in court. One is the Village School case that I referenced, and the other one is Dakota Academy Charter School in Dakota County.
Madam Chair.
And both, Madam Chair, both were the charter school was fighting the termination by the sponsor, and the department was brought in as a in the Village School case, because the state law requires that the department approve or disapprove the decision of a school district to terminate a contract. And the second case, Dakota Academy, that was a district court dispute, and in that case, the charter school again was opposing the termination by the sponsor and brought in the department, not for the same reason as Village School, but just because they tried to compel us to continue funding the school district, the charter school, which we opposed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow up on that. How often do you go to court with other school districts that aren't charter school? Can you tell us about that?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, at times we do have legal disputes with school districts. Most of that is related to one area, and that's special education. We also have the similar disputes with charter schools and special education, but it's very rare that we go to court.
Thank you.
First, Representative Ehler, and then Senator Hand.
Thank you. And Ms. Anderson, I got, I think, two questions. I was just a comment in that question. We were, you know, having been part of this, you know, movement for pretty close to 15 years, which kind of frightens me. Asking, it's an area I know a lot about, so it's just been fascinating. I'm happy for the successes, and we sat and heard three gentlemen who have some dramatically successful schools, and I see a lot of promise in this whole thing, and I hope we can export more of the good ideas that come out of these experimental units, that which is how I see them, and to help more kids. We've been kind of told through different over the years that the lease aid review process is kind of the backstop to guard against, you know, the wrong size buildings and too big of prices and all that. And it sounds to me kind of like the backstop is a little lower backstop than I thought it to be. And so I hope that you keep thinking about that. The auditor made a report in 2003, and again lately another one. Ms. Anderson, is the department going to bring forward a plan? Has there ever been a plan on the lease aid piece the department's brought forward, or are you going to bring one forward about some of the concerns that I know you share about the 30-year, what happens, and what happened like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, we do plan to include provisions in the charter school law in our department bill. We have not yet had that introduced or completed. That will be done in a couple of weeks, and at that time, we're ready to have full hearings on any of the provisions that we're proposing. I will say that we have added language, I believe, on the related parties for charter school lease so that we clear up the conflict of interest provisions. That's something that has been added to the law since 2003, so we have addressed some of these issues over the years.
Madam Chair, just final thing, then I appreciate the dialogue, but is there going to be a lease aid piece to that proposed, do you think?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, we're still finalizing our bill, so I don't want to speculate on that
Fair
point
enough.
Until
Thank
it's introduced.
You.
Thank you very much. And Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe my question is similar to Representative Abler's. I'm curious. I think we would all recognize there are some issues about how we acquire and finance building space, school space for charter schools. In the course of the period of time that your chart on page one of your handout addresses, the enrollment has more than doubled during a period of time when statewide enrollment has actually declined. Looks like there's been some efforts to try to create ways to acquire and use school space for charter schools. Maybe those things are not quite the right solution. Maybe they are, quote, loopholes in existing law. But it would seem to me that the challenge would be, how can we accommodate this growing segment of public education that has apparently got a fairly high demand and do it in a way that satisfies the desire of transparency and scrutiny that we all wish to have? So I guess, just to follow up with Representative Abler, would certainly welcome recommendations from the department on what would be the best mechanism to facilitate schools accommodating students that they're attracting. And so maybe you can, in the course of finalizing your budget proposals, bring us some things that might be helpful.
Thank you very much. You know, I think that we have not talked about the fact that, you know, our traditional public school districts, because I know that whenever we talk about our regular public schools and our charter schools, we want to, you know, be able to respectfully acknowledge they are all public schools, is that we have gone across the state, and Senator Erickson Ropes, we were in your district a year ago this winter, and heard very compelling testimony from a community that had very pressing facility needs and took, 5 years to pass a bond. And those students were really impacted by the lack of facilities, and yet, you know, the law is you go to your voters. And they might welcome to say, is the state willing to take over aid? I'm not advocating for that in this particular year, but I'm just that is an issue that some of our school districts have windows and roof problems and updating facilities, and if their taxpayers are unable to support them, their facilities. And I think that is part of this discussion of equity is who's making decisions. Maybe the department is treating charter schools and traditional school districts, you know, equitably in terms of reviewing plans, but in terms of dispersing dollars, it is not equitable. And so that, I think, is some of the challenge we have, because we're here to, you know, hear from charter schools today, but we also have a significant number of students who continue to be in school districts that are high performing, and that's where they want to be. So I think we're trying to provide choice for all students, and choice may mean being in your traditional school district. And I really appreciate the time you took to this, because this is an issue. We've seen LeaseAid as a dollar amount on a spreadsheet, and so for those of you in the audience who, you know, you deal with this all the time, please understand that this was our attempt to really understand the process and how you work with the departments and some of the questions that are asked. So thank you for just giving us time. Ms. Senator Rummel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think your last comments have triggered something in my head, and I'm just curious about when the state enters into a lease aid agreement with a charter school, does that stay consistent over the life of the charter school?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, the state never enters into a contract for lease aid.
Okay. The way this law works, though, mm-hmm. I mean, if people get the lease aid, does that stay consistent over the life of their...
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, every year the charter school is required to apply for lease aid. If they do not apply for lease aid, they're not going to receive the entitlement or the aid payment. And those plans are reviewed for consistency from year to year. And at times they may need expansion because they're adding grades or a program expansion, and then we'll take a look at those plans more detailed. But every year the charter school is required to send an application to the state.
So given they do that and it passes muster, there's a certain stability in the lease aid support to most charter schools?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, as long as they submit their application, yes.
Okay, so that raises the question, when a district, I'm going to pick on Centennial School District, builds a building and they undertake a bond, and I won't know the technical words for this, if the property value, as I understand it, in the district goes up, the portion that the state pays decreases. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair and Senator Rummel, yes. Both cases were based on statutes, and the variables do change from year to year. So in the case of a school district that's qualifying for debt service equalization, the amount of aid they receive is based on what happens to the property value and what happens to the pupil units, and that will change the mix of aid and levy. The school district will always have the funds it needs to pay the total amount of the principal and interest. It's going to come from state aid, or it's going to go into the school district's debt service levy. The charter school situation is a little bit different. They apply each year for aid. Again, their aid will vary from year to year based on how many students they have. If they have growing enrollment, they can qualify for an increase because the funding is limited to $1,200 per student. If they have declining enrollment, they're going to get less lease aid, even though their lease may be for the same dollar value or growing. So I guess what I would say is that in the case of the school district, there's more stability in terms of knowing that they're going to have the total amount of money they need to make the principal and interest, but there's probably in most cases a declining state share, where with the charter school, they're getting it all from the state. There is no local tax levy, but there's more uncertainty as to what the total amount of money is going to be, because the total amount of money in this case is based on how many students they have and the continuity of the state funding formula, which has been stable for a number of years. But there's more of a backfill, or they have to cover that other 10% of the cost.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you. I think that was much clearer than my question, so I really appreciate your ability to get through my wandering. What happens in, and I'll pick Centennial again, what happens when that when the state portion decreases, the property taxes go up exponentially, partly because the value of the home has gone up, and then because the state portion is less. And so when districts like Centennial need to go out for another bond, the ability to raise the money to do the things that make the school habitable or whatever, it's very hard to pass it. So I'm just making that observation based on what Senator Saltzman already observed, that sometimes these things backfire and they create situations where school districts have, let's call the traditional school districts versus the charter school districts, are forced to have very large class sizes. And I think sometimes that forces a depletion. People move away from their school district because of the class sizes. Whereas if the aid that the state committed to in the beginning of the bond kept some certain, so it didn't compound the taxes of the people, then we would be in a different position. So there is a certain disadvantage to the traditional school district because they use levy money. And I'm just adding on to Senator, very awkwardly, I'm sorry, to Senator Salzman's comment.
It's a very complex issue, and it's in our heads, it's explaining it. And Dr. Melcher, you always explain it really well for us, so thank you
thank you very much.
I'd like to move on to listeners' other questions. I want to thank you all, and certainly if we have follow-up questions, I'm sure that they would be happy to help us with them. I believe we have two charter schools with us today. Is Ms. Thomas here from... Thank you for coming from Minnesota New Country School. And we have, I think, some handouts. I'm going to grab those from her. She has them. And we are delighted to have you with us today. And I know that we've been encouraged to visit charter schools, and many of us have been busy doing that. But I think it's also good to have people come with different perspectives. And the Minnesota New Country School, I've heard so many wonderful things about, and you do have a building corporation, but as we were talking, you really needed a very unique design for your facility, and if you could share that with us, that would be wonderful. And also identify yourself just for the tape.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dee Thomas from Minnesota New Country School in Henderson. We're lucky to be celebrating our 15th year of operation. So when we started looking at buildings and doing that, when we opened our doors in 1994, we opened in three storefronts in Le Sueur. And we decided that having kids going across streets and roads was probably not a good idea because they needed to do that. That became our hallways. So we decided we needed to get people in and under one roof. So we started talking about what could we do to get a building put together in order to get the kids all in one spot. So we talked to the city of Henderson, and we also talked to the city of Le Sueur to see what we could do about getting a school in that particular area. And we developed CCI, which is Community Capital Incorporated. And it was first developed as a sub-asset corporation, and we had 13 local investors who invested in it. And it was in Henderson. They were more willing to work with us at that point in time than Le Sueur, because Le Sueur already had the high school in town. We created the CCI. It was a sole proprietorship, and we created it for providing a facility for New Country. We talked and spoke with the city of Henderson and also with the city of Le Sueur and spoke with both of them about this becoming a community project. So we were able to work with them, and we created a fairly unique public-private partnership and worked hard to create that in order to get the school building up. We had investors, business people on Main Street put up 10% of the cash for the building. And then we also worked with the city of Henderson for the tax increment financing. So they put a package together for us. The county did a small economic development loan. And then our local bank, working along with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, gave us the loan. The USDA Community Facilities Loan Guarantee Program actually guaranteed the loan. So we were able to put up a building. And then, and the building was a $1.2 million construction. And around the school, we also, the Lions Club within the community, also put in excessive amounts of money to create a nice baseball field for our kids to play on and a variety of other things. So it really did become a community effort. In 1992, Representative Intenza started questioning whether you should have a for-profit corp. So listening to that and being very aware of that, we decided that that CCI needed to become a nonprofit. So we went through the paperwork and converted Community Capital Inc. to a nonprofit status. And that's what we're working with today. We still work with the tax increment financing. We still work with the EDA loan. So we're working with local economic development and working with that. And that's rolled in there. We did go back to Community Capital Inc. as Minnesota New Country School, and we asked them if we could put on a $3,200 expansion, because what we found was with project-based learning, we were unable to have enough square footage to work with kids. So we put on a 3,200 square foot addition, and we did that. That one was financed with a second mortgage with the National Co-op Bank. So currently we're working with CCI, and it's headed up. They meet four times a year. It has a board. It has its own current board, and they volunteer. There's no pay for the board to work. And it's a corporation that basically looks at holding the school. We look at the lease, and as we've rolled out the lease that we get does not cover the cost of the building. So we pay CCI, I think we get lease aid of $231,000 from the state, or $184,000 from the state. Our actual lease is $231,000. So we do take about $47,000 to $50,000 off of our general education aid in order to pay off the rest of the lease on the building. And at this point in time, I guess we do question, would it be possible to own a building? We've been in place for 15 years. We're fairly strong. We try to maintain a good fund balance. We work at that very hard. I looked at our lease with CCI. The mortgage payback will be done in 2017. It's a very good question as to what do you do when that's done? But we are also looking at upkeep on the building right now, and that comes out of our gen ed aid right now. So I am taking money off the top of my general education budget to put into maintenance for the building, because the money that we get for lease aid does not cover any of the maintenance on the building. And when I was principal at one of the neighboring districts, I had 17 funding mechanisms that I could access for buildings. As a director of a charter school, I have one funding for buildings, and that's lease aid. And if we took that off right now, the lease proportion of our budget is about one-fourth of our budget. And if I needed to take $250,000 off the top of our budget, I don't know how I could supply a quality program for our children.
So could you tell us a little bit about your charter school, because it has a very unique focus in how you approach educating your students, and how this building was very unique. I mean, that did you look at existing school space? Would that have worked for you had it been available?
Madam Chair, it would not have. We do project-based learning, so we look at the students and we say, what's your passion? And we have students follow their passion. It's a very hands-on learning situation. Through that passion area, we weave in all of the state standards, making sure that they meet all state standards. But it's a messy process because we have 125 students all working on different projects, and it takes space to do that. So as we were looking at current buildings and things that were in Le Sueur and in Henderson at the time, trying to figure out if we could utilize some space that was already existing, we could not find anything that would work. And if you would walk into Minnesota New Country, you would see a wide open area, more like a gymnasium, in which all the kids work. It looks more like a working office space than it looks like a school. We don't have separate rooms. Every student has a desk and a computer, a cubicle that becomes their own area to work in. And we would not be able to do the project-based learning that we've been doing for 15 years if we had a different setup.
And your school is 150 students, 82 students?
Senator Salzman, we have 125 students, and that is our cap limit.
Okay. I knew it was a reasonable number. So anyway, very good. And so is your when you say that you're capped by your charter, by your because the state hasn't capped you, but you have capped yourselves at 125 students. Okay, very good. Are there questions for Ms. Thomas? Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. How many grades?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, we operate with grades 6 through 12.
And Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair, could you tell us how your students did on the standardized tests? How are they doing?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, our students score very well on SATs, ACTs, on the state-mandated tests. They don't always do wonderfully well. Last year, 80% of my incoming students were 2 years or more behind in English and math. And so when they come in as an eighth grader and need to take an eighth grade class and they're 2 years behind, to date, we have only waived two students in 15 years on the state-mandated tests. We're also operating at 40% special ed. And so it's pretty amazing to have only waived two students in 15 years on those tests. Our average on ACTs, SAT scores, ACTs in particular, are 2 points higher than the state average right now for our students. So they're scoring well. 100% of our students last year were admitted to college and are going.
Just a brief question, because if Representative Abler was here, he would want to know the answer to this, is that we've talked about innovation. And part of what we believe that the mission of charter schools was is that to create innovation, but we're finding that we're not really, there's not an innovation transfer. We were talking about tech transfer earlier today in our business committee, but, you know, talking about innovation transfer, do you have any brief suggestions on how we could do a better job of making sure that the good things that you're doing, to offer those, to make sure that our other traditional public schools are aware of those?
Senator Salzman, we're working very closely with Minnesota State University. We are hoping that they will help spread the information and help us do workshops. We've also created a lab school. Last year we entertained over 500 visitors. This year Staples Motley has brought in the majority of their staff to see what they're doing. They're talking about doing project-based learning in a large portion of their high school. We've also had Erie, Kansas has come in. I will be traveling to Hawaii next month to do workshops there. And so we continue to pull in schools from all over, including schools in Minnesota, in looking at trying to spread what we do out. But the majority of the 500 visitors that we have coming through are educators that are looking at trying to do portions of the project-based learning.
Very good. Senator Rummel.
This is fascinating. Thank you.
Representative Norton.
What kind of assessments do you use with your students? You've got about 20 students per grade level. How do you assess their performance?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, we do NWEA testing, so we do longitudinal data of our students. So we follow students over time to see the growth that they're making, to make sure that they're doing at least a year's progress each year. We're hoping, especially for students who are far behind, that we're moving them up 1, 2, maybe even 3 years. We also have put in place a study called the HOPE Study. And the HOPE Study was developed by, it was developed probably 20 years ago. But we're working with the University of Minnesota, Mark Van Ryzen, and The HOPE study looks at self-efficacy of the students, belongingness of goal setting, orientation, belongingness. And so we're looking at that, and it's been proven that if we can raise those levels with students, their success in post-secondary institutions doubles. So those are the things that we're looking at very closely with those students. We also look at the MCA scores very closely. We want all students to be able to pass that. We just know that if we have students coming in 2 years behind, it may take us a year or two to catch those students up to where they need to be.
Very good. And Representative Norton.
Well, this is fascinating, and I don't want to throw water on it, but there's no reason that a choice school in a regular school district cannot also be innovative. It doesn't necessarily have to be under the guise of charter schools. Mm-hmm. And I would use, we have both charter and choice schools in the Rochester Public Schools, each of which have very unique, nothing quite as fascinating as you have going. So I just throw that in the mix, that we don't necessarily have to develop a charter school in order to have innovations, but we do also have roadblocks, financial, as a matter of fact, in this state that prohibit choice schools from developing and actually encourage charter schools. So I just thought I'd throw that out for the discussion, too.
And that's a good point, and I know there is a proposal. There are people here tonight in the audience who aren't going to testify but are looking at how do we support innovation within our traditional public schools as well. That's something that we want to look at. Thank you, Ms. Thomas, for coming all the way from Le Sueur, correct?
Henderson.
From Henderson to be with us tonight, and safe travels home. And we really, really appreciate your testimony, and I think there's great interest in your school. So
thank you very much.
Very good. And now if Mr. Fung is here from the Nova Classical Academy. Mr. Fung, I want to welcome you. I know that that a number of parents from your school have been here before and started to talk about LEASAID. But LEASAID wasn't really our agenda item, so I'd really like to hear more about how you have worked to set up a building corporation, and some of the other questions I think would be really helpful for us to just have a better understanding of your academy.
Wonderful. Again, my name is Simon Fung, for the record. I'm one of the founders and also current board member. I also asked Mr. Tomblin to join me. He's actually more knowledgeable in terms of the lease and all that, you know, when it comes to building facilities issues.
Very good.
Before that, I'd like to tell you a little bit about Nova Classical Academy. Nova was really started by three parents who were serving on a St. Paul School District site council. We were not happy with the kind of education our children were getting. So at the time, we had all kinds of frustrations with the school district and also with the administrator. So we decided the only way to do it, you know, for the quality, for high-quality education for our kids is to start our own charter school. We've been in operation for currently on the 6 years right now. And it's fair to say that we've had a really tough role. Lots of ups and downs, but I have to say that in terms of quality education, we are currently spending, based on the state money, at a cost of $70, you know, approximately 18% less than the state average, and yet we also attract students from all over the Twin Cities. In the meantime, our kids also score extremely high on, you know, on the MCA scores. So you look at it, and also we have a very long waiting list when it comes to, you know, the classes. So, you know, you might say, you know, so what? You look at all these high figures with the, you know, legal requirements with the LEASAID, with all these cold hard facts about, you know, also about schools closing, but we look at our school as one that is going to be, I would say, still going to be around long after I'm gone. So we would like to see that, you know, we have a stable facility for us, so you don't have to worry about our school facility from year to year. So in terms of about facility, I'm going to turn this over for Tom to cover that.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. My name is Tom Blint, for the record. And I am a parent of a fourth grader and a second grader, and I've been involved with facilities since the school's inception 6 years ago. We looked for a long time for a facility that fit us to begin with. We were originally a K-5 school, and eventually found a Catholic, 1950s built Catholic school that was kind enough to let us lease. And after 2 years, immediately ran out of room because we were growing so fast. And they were nice enough to build out what used to be the sanctuary in the lower level into additional classrooms and then add it back into our lease. And so we've lived in that space. After 2 years, we ran out of space again, and we added modulars to behind our building, and we're currently out of space again. Mm-hmm. Interesting things about charter schools is that we are a public school. We're a school district unto ourselves. Yet, as we've talked about today, we can't own a building. We don't have that possibility. The other thing about growth in a charter school, it's really a problem area because we can only afford as much building as we add each year. However, buildings aren't built that way. You don't have to tack on little pieces of a building every year and pay for them that way. You typically squeeze as much as you can in the building you're in and then go to a building that's a little bit bigger than what you can afford, and you take money out of your general aid to pay for it until you grow into it. You squeeze into that building, and you know, it's kind of a hopscotch process when a charter school grows. We currently have 405 students. Full growth for us will probably be somewhere between 800 and 1,200 students. So at that process, we're going to have to go through that process a number of times to get to the size building we need. A great suggestion would be to simply let us own our own building. Then we could afford it, structure the lease so that we could pay a little bit in the beginning and grow into the lease as we get larger. We would love the opportunity to educate all the kids who want to come to Nova. Like I said, we have 408 now. We have over 400 on the waiting list that simply can't get in because we don't have enough facility to support them. And so we would ask the state to help us in that quest. We probably need a building 80 to 100,000 square feet that we just simply can't afford right now because we're only about halfway to our full growth.
Could you explain a little bit about your building corporation? Because you do have a building corporation, I understand.
We don't have a building corporation as of yet. We're in the process of applying for one, but we don't have one.
Okay.
We haven't gone through that whole process.
Okay, very good. And so you are in the process of looking at a building corporation, and then you'd like to use that to develop a permanent site.
That's one potential. We're looking at any way, really, we can advance our facilities issue. We've looked at split campuses where we lease two sites. We've looked at a building corporation that would be someone we'd lease through. We've looked at Charter School Development Corporation out of Washington, D.C. that helps charter schools grow. We're looking at any means we can to grow.
Right. You know, a statement at one of our last meetings was that at a time of limited resources, we, in some communities, are closing schools and then we're building schools. And then I also hear that some of our school districts are not really working with charter school groups to use existing space. And I think of St. Paul as a school district that has, I believe, flat or declining enrollment. I don't think it's growing. And what is the role of that in all this? Because I think we go back to taxpayers are paying are still paying off bonds on some schools, and then we're pulling kids out or using state money to build new buildings. And so and perhaps you don't have a suggestion today, but I think it would be helpful to look at that of how we use existing resources. I know in Senator Bonoff's bill on shared services, which we won't go into today, but I know we talked about where are there greater efficiencies. And one of the areas was real estate and facilities. And I asked the presenter, tell me what that means. And he said, it's how you use existing space, how you use your existing square footage. So if you have some thoughts on that for us, that would be very helpful as well.
Certainly. We've explored those possibilities since we've been in existence, actually before we've been in existence. We, while planning for the school, we called the city or the St. Paul School District and the Minneapolis School District and asked for any vacant buildings that were available. We'd love to move in and work with them. we were told in both cases, no, nothing was available. Minneapolis has had, I think they have about 18 school buildings that are sitting vacant right now that up until this year, finally, they've worked with charter schools to make some of those buildings available. 2 years ago when they put some of the buildings up for lease, one of the provisions that they put in that lease agreement was that charter schools or private schools could not lease those buildings, which I found quite preposterous, that a public school couldn't rent from another public school, but that's what they wrote in the provisions.
Well, and at the same time, and I know there's a question here from Senator Hand, is that those buildings have already been paid for with public money. So then there's a sense of more public money to use of existing facilities. So, I mean, again, I don't have an answer, but it does make it kind of recumbent.
And, Madam Chair,
just Senator Hand.
I know this is a problem, and I've talked to a number of charter schools, and I think within the last year we did have some change at the Minneapolis school where now they are willing to work with charters. But it has not been generally a very favorable climate. And I did have a bill a couple of years ago, I think it was last year, the year before, that was trying to offer at least or require when you are leaving a building as a public school entity that you would have to at least consider an offer from another public entity to purchase or use that property. But I think that there hasn't been the spirit of sort of general cooperation on solving education space issues between charters and the traditional public schools, and there may be some things we could do to facilitate that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
It would appear that form of reasoning doesn't necessarily stop the flow of students from the public school to charters.
And that, I think, is if we could solve that issue of, forming, greater cooperation between all of our public schools, that it there is an issue, because when children do move in and out of a district, and I think that's some of what we've talked about in other, is that we're hearing today from many schools that are very, very successful. It is the charter schools that are struggling that are having an impact on our traditional public schools as children go in and out, and also financial stability. So I would welcome your continuing dialogue on this if you have suggestions, because I think that we've heard a number of proposals from different education groups, and we will be getting those out to people. We have a great grid that Kent put together that's excellent to kind of look at what the different groups suggested. But on Lee State, I think even the department is where might we go in addressing some of the concerns of the legislative auditor? So if you have suggestions, Mr. Funk, let's
see. Madam Chair and members of the committee, it's always viewed, in a general sense, that charter schools are competitors of the traditional public school. I really don't see it that way. I look at it and say, look, you have two really options for parents to select school. It's not like we have a secret formula. The only thing is we're working harder, taking more innovative approach. For example, we have, believe it or not, Nova also has Saturday schools. The only difference is the parents also come with the kids. We're making the kids, along with the parents, to really work hard to bring them up to the level that they need to be. We're serving students in a way that perhaps is a little different from the traditional public school. So that's kind of how I see it.
Good. With that, thank you very much for being here today on a snowy evening. And Mr. Piccolo, I believe that you are on the agenda.
Senator Saltzman and members, I want to address a few follow-up issues that have been raised in the conversation this afternoon. First of all, I just want to reiterate that, charter school students are public school students, and the lease aid is for their education. It is not for building. I mean, it's for purposes of where they go to school, but it is basically A, to assist their education. One of the things that was mentioned, and if you note in the chart that Mr. Melcher presented to you, the difference between lease aid and lease costs. Charter schools are taking about $7.5 million out of the classroom to pay for lease aid, for lease costs, because lease aid does not cover the full cost. And if you look at it, it's roughly the equivalent of what was cut 6 years ago in terms of lease aid to schools, which suffered a 20% cut 6 years ago in lease aid. So basically, that money is coming out of the classroom for other purposes and education of the kids. Third, I just wanted to mention that actually charter schools, if you look at the facilities they're in, because they are leased, they have to meet current code for all buildings. So when a school leases from a private property owner, whatever organization it is, that building's got to be brought up to code, current code for building code. And a lot of traditional public school buildings are not up to code because they are grandfathered in. So charter school facilities are not grandfathered in terms of meeting all the code requirements. Next, it was just mentioned about the districts leasing to charter schools. There have been a number of districts around the state who have passed policies that do not allow the leasing of their excess surplus buildings that have been designated surplus buildings to charter schools. In fact, we had a community in northern Minnesota where they sold the old high school to a nonprofit organization, the Boys Club, Girls and Boys Club, and they put in the purchase agreement that the Boys and Girls Club could not rent out the gymnasium to the charter school during school hours. That's how defined people have gotten in this thing. And I think if you look on your chart, in terms of a couple schools, I'll give you an example of how people have been creative in using space and working with other organizations. City Academy, which is on the first page of Mr. Melcher's chart, you will see their lease cost per foot is only $4.80, because basically they lease a community recreation center in the city of St. Paul. And so basically they are paying for costs, they're part of the cost of that building. Cedar Riverside, which is right above that, their lease cost is $4.23 per square foot. They're basically in a public housing building, part of the Cedar Riverside Public Housing Center on the west bank of the river in Minneapolis. So people have found, charter schools have found ways to work with other government agencies to place their schools in different kinds of facilities to reduce costs. Finally, a couple other things. One, there has been an issue over the years of how long leases could be. One of the things that has happened is at times the department has indicated that leases cannot be longer than the term of a charter. Charters in Minnesota, as you know, can only be up to 3 years at a time. And so, therefore, most of our leases are very short, which drives up the lease costs. And so we would like to see that schools can have longer leases. If a school goes out of business, obviously it doesn't cost anything because they're leasing the property. But it does drive the cost up, especially if they have to do build-out and so forth as part of remodeling for that school. It has to be paid back on a much shorter time period, which raises lease costs rather than amortizing over a longer period of time. It was also mentioned in terms of public schools that once they're paid off, what happens in terms of that the charter schools are at advantage over the public school districts. One of the things we know is that when a district builds a building, one new building, it amortizes that cost of the building against all of its buildings. So none of its buildings are ever paid off. Again, I mean, the whole district it's not against one building. So to say that, what happens when a building is paid off for a charter school, what are you going to do? There are still going to be building costs to replacing the roof, those kinds of things that need to be to keep up that building up to code and so forth.
Mr. Piccolo, yes. And maybe I don't have this right, but when a a school district goes to its voters to build a new building.
Right.
And when that bond is paid off, it's done. They don't continue to receive dollars from the taxpayers in the form of a levy to pay for that. And then they have to absorb the cost of the upkeep of that building into their operating capital. Would that be correct?
Mm-hmm. I believe they get the operating capital to do some of that, yes.
And so with a charter school, once a bond is paid off and the it is owned by a what would be the rationale that a charter school would continue to receive this additional lease aid when the building has sort of been paid for free and clear? Because in a school district, once the bond is paid off, you just don't get to keep the you don't get to keep receiving the levy from your voters once the bond is done.
I would suspect what would happen is that the lease cost would go down because there's still costs of that building mm-hmm. to the landlord, whoever that landlord is, whether it's a public school, whether it's a for-profit landlord, whether it's a nonprofit. There's still costs to that building.
Right,
and so the lease aid would probably come down right. for the charter school because their lease would go down. Their lease payments would go down.
Well, I think what I'm getting at here, and I think we've talked about before, is that when a building company is responsible for build, I mean, they sell the bonds. And once the school is paid off, I think the question is, why are we continuing to give lease aid that is above and beyond what a public school would get once that building is paid off? And perhaps Mr. Nauman is, are you following where I'm going with this in terms of would you like to, maybe perhaps you might be able to frame it and.
Madam Chair, I guess the thought that I would have for you is I'm not sure that when the legislature drafted the charter school building lease aid that it contemplated that that was going to be an avenue towards ownership. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think what you're having is entrepreneurial charter schools that have figured out a way to utilize the existing law that generates the lease levy, and that is a path for some on the way towards ownership. That said, the legislature has never spoken again on the question of maybe we should reduce the lease aid, given the logic that once the building is paid off, that maybe some lower amount, I suppose, as has been testified to, logic could dictate that the lease would go down once the building is paid off, assuming that there's no bond payments going in. But there certainly is no requirement that it do so.
So, Mr. Piccolo, just some suggestion for me, I speak for myself, is that I think we've heard the arguments on both sides of this issue, but I think there are a number of questions that have been raised, and it would be really helpful to hear from your perspective if we were to go down the road of charter schools, of us more formally sort of blessing that process and acknowledging, because right now it's very clear, and it's even a little hazy with these board-appointed nonprofit corporations, which we really didn't get to very much today. The link between those is if bonds are issued and lease aid is used to pay those buildings off, what happens after the bonds are paid? That would just be something to think about for us to maybe make a suggestion. And Senator Bonoff?
Madam Chair, I think I need some clarification. I might need Mr. Nauman, but perhaps since you've studied this, you could answer this question.
I think Mr. Nauman would be a better source.
But it seems to me from what I understand in today's testimony that we pay, we're capped, the state is capped at a certain percent of what the charter school's lease payments are, and that's part of the equation that goes into how much we pay. So if the bonds are paid off, one would expect that the lease would come substantially down, and so in fact our state obligation would correspondingly go down. I guess I'm still trying to figure out why there's a lease in a situation where now we own the building. But what are we leasing, and from who, and how to?
But the question, Senator Bonoff, is that we don't own the building. It is owned by a private nonprofit corporation that we have. The state has provided lease aid to the school, And they, in turn, use their lease aid to pay this nonprofit Friends Group, which is many times what I understand appointed by the school board. So it's they are very close, they are linked to pay off the bonds, because you cannot use lease aid to pay off bonds. So that's where it's a little, there's gray area, as the legislative auditor pointed out, that it's sort of a loophole that whether you want to call it a loophole or it's being creative. But I think that the question is, we're using state money to buy buildings. And in the end, the question is, when the bonds are paid off, someone has suggested, well, what stops that nonprofit from selling the building and going on to something else, which is not really going to serve the charter school very well. But I think it's just questions, and they're just questions that we need to be able to answer, perhaps. Senator Olson?
Well, if a person has a rent subsidy and they're renting an apartment, and it's whoever owns that apartment, at some point their debt is paid off. Whoever heard of somehow mandating that the rent goes down? I'm not sure how you manage that, but I think it perhaps means that we ought to revisit, why wouldn't you allow a charter school to own property? Because if they're in fact doing that, then they have it paid off. Their costs are different. Yes, there's ongoing costs for maintenance, but it may not be the same thing. It would be more openly reflected, but we have injected in that policy that they do have to get something. They can't own it, so somebody else does. And so it's like whether you build equity by renting or whether you let somebody else do that, use your money.
But it is state money. It's not private money, Senator Olson. I think that's the question, is that it is an open appropriation.
Yeah.
And when you look at special education is not an open appropriation. It is capped. And as a result, as costs have gone up, the amount that is, paid to school district for their actual costs have many times gone down without the help of Senator Rummel. We're trying to more fully fund that. So it's a question. I don't think anyone has ruled out that charter schools shouldn't own buildings. It's just sort of how we're allowing that to happen, and what kind of transparency is there. I think that's what I'm hearing today, perhaps. So,
well, Madam Chair, it's government involved in things complicates things, and some of the natural processes that we see functioning in our free market society we kind of turn them on their head. Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting that we have to do it the same way, but we ought to be honest in recognizing that it's our policies that are part of what's forcing some of these kinds of behaviors. Would people invest in a building if there wasn't some return on it, even if they're leasing it to whoever they're leasing it to, be it a charter school or whatever else?
Do you have a question, Representative Norton?
I did, Madam Chair. Perhaps some of the rest of you have this. I'm new to the committee, so if I'm asking for something you already have, just tell me and get it to me and we'll be fine. But it would help me in this discussion to know a couple bits of information, like we have the number of charter schools on the form that were developed in each year as we've gone along. It would help me to understand how many of these are still in existence and how long did they last, to help me get a feel for some of these questions about the length of time charter schools are staying open. And and also, I guess it would be helpful, and again, maybe you have this, which links to qualifications that we might be looking at, AYP performance at the same time as we're looking at this, so that we can use some of those measurements to make some of these decisions that will be coming down the line later this year. So if I could get my hands on that, if it's already available.
We do have some past handouts that we could certainly share with you.
Would you?
That would be
very
happy
helpful.
To. So.
Thank you.
And Mr. Nauman, did you want to add anything?
I think you're covering it correct. Fine, unless there's a question for me. I guess I would add one thing, that the charter school law does speak fairly clearly that it's money that received from state sources that is prohibited from being used to purchase land or buildings. But that same statute then goes on and says that charter schools, it's perfectly fine for them to own land and buildings. There is no prohibition from that under the law. And it sounded like you might have been talking a little bit about that point, so I thought that might be helpful.
So, Mr. Bigelow, do you have anything else to add?
Just a comment. Yes. You asked about the interlinking between those nonprofit corporations. Part of that comes from the legal requirements under federal guidelines as these property companies are established. There is two legal thoughts. One legal thought says they have to be totally separate boards, and there's another legal thought that says they have to be interlinking. And depending which legal counsel people have used, they have different kinds of governance structures for those two corporations. Some are totally separate boards, and others are linked boards where they have some members from both boards on each. In terms of charter schools owning schools directly, one of our concerns is we would prefer that we just legitimize what these building companies are doing, because one of the downsides that we look at is if a charter school owns a building directly and it closes and has bonds, then the state is going to be responsible for those bonds because all the assets and the, you know, go back to the state. And I suspect the liabilities would go back to the state for those bonds then to the state to pay for. So I think there has to be a careful reflection about, do you want to do that? And our suggestion is don't go there. Allow these building companies, it maintains the, and if you know, if there's a requirement to require two separate boards, I think that's something we have to look at legally with the federal determination of nonprofits.
Very good.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Bigelow, could you, do the other entities, when they're attempting to get capital to either build or provide, do they? I would presume that they assess the risk.
Yes.
I mean, if there's always risk in this, whether this entity is going to be around, and whether a bank, I would think, would want to have some evidence in that. There's nothing wrong with us doing that either, is it? I mean, there's some kind of assessment of risk before you make an investment.
Senator Saltzman, Senator Olson, if you're talking about the schools owning the buildings directly, yes, I think the state would have
We would have to if we were
going
to go that route.
Would have to do some risk assessment. What's happened when there have been building companies owned, you know, by another nonprofit. For example, the one case here in St. Paul, the old Science Museum building was a charter school. They had a building company. The bondholders held that building for 2 years before they could find a seller, so they ate the cost of that, those bonds, for 2 years. If that would happen, you know, schools owning it directly, the state might be the one eating those costs for 2 years until they could sell that asset.
Very good, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Piccolo, just most of the charter schools do not have building corporations.
Correct.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Piccolo, that my sense is, and maybe you can clarify or correct or amplify, but many charters, maybe most, are leasing property, leasing space from some other entity. And it's my understanding that that the entities that they lease from are not necessarily nonprofit entities. Is that correct?
Senator Saltzman, Senator Hahn, that is true. There are some who lease from private property owners. There are some who lease from churches, some who lease from public schools, districts, some who lease from other nonprofits that are social service agencies or something. There's all kinds of landlords that we have.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much, Mr. Bigelow. And as you know, we will continue to be in dialogue about this. So thank you very much. I believe a couple people we did have, we have about 15 minutes or less for public testimony. If there's anyone who would like to have any comments for the committee, we would certainly welcome them. If anybody wants to. All right. At this point, I want to thank the committee. We will, I think at our next committee, what we're going to be looking at is looking at the grid. We'll get that out to you in advance. You can look at some of the proposals that have come out from many of the other groups. sort of looking at, we've talked about accountability, we've talked about sponsorship, and just to give up a sense of where there's overlap in that, one of the areas that I believe we have not talked about, but there is an interest in, is talking about desegregation and separation of church and state. And I would welcome your comments as we put that agenda together. And I want it to be a very respectful and balanced discussion to look at our current laws and frankly, to look at some of the issues that have come up. And are they an issue, or are we overreacting? But I think that there has been some concerns about that area, and I do believe it would be worth our while to consider that, especially in the fact that there have been, we've heard from a number of charter schools who are very effective, but there's been concerns about segregation and how we deal with that. So, Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, just a technical thing. If we leave things in our folder, do you leave
them
there for us?
Yes. If you leave these in our, this will be your charter school working groups. If you want to keep them, they, I think, will be in my office if you want to ever come and get them. And thank you, Representative Norton, for staying with us and put your stuff in. We'll pick up your stuff as well if you'd like and keep it for you. With that, meeting adjourned.
Thank you, Kathy.
Good. Oh.